The holidays sneak up fast, but it's not too early to get your shopping done and actually have fun with it. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. The products from Uncommon Goods are high quality, they're unique, a lot of times they're handmade, and they're made in the United States. Many are crafted by independent artists and small businesses. And because they're made in small batches, the best finds can sell out fast. I can't tell you how many times I've gone to Uncommon Goods when I didn't know what to get that person who seemed to already have everything. Another great thing about Uncommon Goods is that they give back a dollar to a nonprofit partner of your choice every time you buy something. So far, they've donated over $3 million to nonprofits. So shop early, have fun, and cross some names off your list today. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/JFK. That's uncommongoods.com/JFK for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary. If you listen to Solving JFK a lot, you know that I like to keep the vibes up. And that's why I'm a fan of federally legal cannabis from Mood.com. It's a brand that uses small organic farms to source its pesticide-free legal weed. You can get 20% off of your first order at Mood.com by using code JFK. My favorite product of theirs is the functional THC gummies. Usually I go with Epic Euphoria, but I also like Magic Mind and the Pure Relief CBD gummies. These legal weed gummies take about 20 minutes to kick in, and you can control the dosage yourself. Unlike the federal government, Mood.com has never sold drugs to fund illegal wars or clandestine missions. Thanks, Mood.com. So try out some of the excellent legal cannabis products from Mood.com and get a 20% discount off of your first order using code JFK. Thus far in this section on the Mafia, we've looked at the history of American organized crime, with the Kennedy brothers playing an adversarial role in that story, beginning with the McClellan Committee. We heard what the Church Committee had to say when it came to Robert Mayhew and the CIA mafia plots to kill Fidel Castro. Then, we learned that Johnny Rosselli was still embedded with the Cuban exiles, even after the Church Committee said that he was not. We've given the spotlight to the most prominent bosses who were most likely to have been involved if there was any mafia involvement in Kennedy's assassination. As we learned in the last episode, Santos Traficante claimed that 15 Cuban exiles were hired by him to be part of a team to kill Fidel Castro. We'll cover Cuban exiles in depth soon, but until then, it's important to remember that there's not necessarily a clear line between the mafia and the Cuban exiles. Many of the exiles were also mob-affiliated. In this episode, we turn our attention to New Orleans boss Carlos Marcello. Did Marcello have any ties to Lee Harvey Oswald? And what support is there for the idea that Carlos Marcello was the one who ordered the hit on President Kennedy?
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Dallas police this morning resumed custody of the man they have formally charged with the assassination of President Kennedy.
Was Oswald acting alone, or was he a member of a conspiracy? The mission answers, he acted alone.
I'm working.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton. Calogero Minicore, also known as Carlos Marcelo, was born in French Tunisia and moved with his family to Metairie, Louisiana as a baby. As a teen, he was the mastermind of a group of young thugs that carried out robberies in towns surrounding New Orleans. Marcelo received a 14-year prison sentence for those robberies, but only served 5 years after he was pardoned by the governor. He wasn't out of the slammer long before he was charged with trafficking marijuana and given a long prison sentence, of which he served only 10 months. When Marcelo got out of prison for the second time, that's when he really started to build his empire. He began to operate a slot machine network with New York boss Frank Costello. Marcelo owned Jefferson Music Company, which dominated the slot machine, pinball, and jukebox trade in New Orleans. He also owned the largest racing wire service in New Orleans. On top of that, Marcelo controlled the two best-known casinos in the Big Easy, including the Beverly Country Club, which brought Marcelo into partnership with Meyer Lansky. By 1963, Carlos Marcelo's New Orleans family was bringing in over $1.1 billion per year. And Marcelo wasn't just making money, he was also the most respected boss within La Cosa Nostra, according to FBI agent Patrick Collins, who investigated Marcelo. Because New Orleans was the oldest La Cosa Nostra family, Marcelo could make decisions on his own without going to the commission, even though he usually did. The boss whom Marcelo was closest to was Santos Traficante. Marcelo told the HSCA that his relationship with Traficante was strictly social and that he had no ownership in Cuba. However, when Marcelo spoke to the HSCA, he denied ever receiving money from Las Vegas or doing anything illegal for that matter. So we can't necessarily take Marcelo's HSCA testimony to the bank. Given his overlapping interests with Traficante, it wouldn't be surprising if Marcelo was profiting from Cuba somehow. Either way, Marcelo showed his desire for a Castro-free Cuba by backing Cuban exiles in their fight to oust the bearded dictator. Marcelo supported Tony Verona's Cuban Revolutionary Council, which, in New Orleans, was led by David Ferry's friend, Sergio Arcacha Smith, and, for a period of time, had its offices at 544 Camp Street in the same building as Guy Bannister. Marcelo was also a longtime supporter of Lyndon Johnson. As previously noted, Jack Halfin claimed that he funneled at least $500,000 from Marcelo's gambling profits to Lyndon Johnson in the 1950s. In exchange, Johnson always voted against anti-racketeering laws. Halfin was sent to prison in 1964 and was later given a full pardon by President Lyndon Johnson in 1966. Many researchers point to links between the uncle of Lee Harvey Oswald, Charles Dutz Moret, and the Marcelo crime family. So what is the evidence linking Moret to Carlos Marcelo? First, Dutz Moret, who married Marguerite Oswald's sister Lillian, was, according to the HSCA, quote, associated with organized crime figures in New Orleans, having worked for years in an underworld gambling syndicate affiliated with the Carlos Marcelo crime family. The Warren Commission interviewed Moret, but did not ask him what he did for a living. Both John Pick, Oswald's half-brother, and Lillian Moret, Dutz's wife, told the commission that Dutz was in the bookmaking business. Later, Lillian Moret told the HSCA that her husband worked in the gambling business with Sam Saya for years. Moret's children, Marilyn and Jean, also confirmed their father's relationship with Saya. Even Marguerite Oswald said that Dutz Moret worked with Saya and that they knew each other for years. Thus, there is an overwhelming amount of evidence that Moret was a bookie and that he worked with Sam Saya. So who exactly was Sam Saya? According to the HSCA, Saya, quote, was identified by various federal and state authorities as an organized crime leader in New Orleans. The head of the New Orleans Metropolitan Crime Commission, Aaron Cohn, said Saya, quote, had the reputation of being very close to Carlos Marcello. In addition to working regularly with Saya, Moret also managed a boxer named Tony Chambra, who went on to become a lieutenant under Saya in the Marcello crime family. The HSCA Organized Crime Report also relayed a story about how Marguerite Oswald implied that Dutz Moret had close proximity to Marcello when she met an old friend at a dinner party in 1970 in Waco, Texas. An unnamed businessman and his wife were hosting Marguerite at their home at the time. They took her to a party where Marguerite used a different name. At that party, a man named Sam Termine, who was a former bodyguard and chauffeur for Carlos Marcello, walked up to Marguerite and said, "I know you." She then recognized the man, and the two spoke about Termine's friendship with Dutz Moret and his association with Sam Saya. The anonymous businessman later met Carlos Marcello in New Orleans at the introduction of Termine and said it was apparent that Termine and Marcello had a close relationship. When the HSCA asked Marguerite Oswald about Termine, she said she may have known him, but refused to provide any other information about him. So it's established with certainty that Dutz Moret worked closely as a bookie with Sam Saya, who reported to Carlos Marcello. We also have the link of boxer Tony Chambra and apparently Marguerite Oswald, all confirming that Dutz Moret was connected with these folks and that even she knew Marcello's bodyguard and chauffeur, Sam Termine. The next issue here is whether Lee Harvey Oswald was close enough to Dutz Moret for his relationship with Marcello to matter. Would Oswald have been exposed to any of the trappings of organized crime when he was around Moret? According to New Orleans Crime Commissioner Aaron Cohn, the place where Oswald lived from 1955 to 1956, 126 Exchange Place, was a hotspot for the New Orleans Mafia. Cohn said, quote, "Exchange Alley, specifically that little block that Oswald lived on, was literally the hub of some of the most notorious underworld joints in the city." We don't know to what extent a 16-year-old Lee Harvey Oswald was aware of his underworld-dominated neighborhood, but it's worth noting that his apartment was physically surrounded by Marcello-affiliated businesses as a teen. Growing up, Oswald regularly spent Friday nights and all day Saturday with the Moretts and would stay with them anytime his mom was traveling or was unavailable. Oswald also relied on the Moretts again when he came back to New Orleans in the spring of 1963. He stayed with them for a few weeks until his uncle Dutz loaned him the money to move into an apartment on Magazine Street with Marina and June. In the summer of 1963, while living in New Orleans, Marina and Lee regularly had dinner with the Moretts. After Lee was arrested for getting into a fight while handing out Fair Play for Cuba committee flyers, he was bailed out of jail by Emile Bruno, a friend of Dutz Moret and close associate of Carlos Marcello's number three man, Nofio Pecora. It is therefore clear that Lee Harvey Oswald was close to his mom's sister's family, including his uncle Dutz. In the interest of showing just how close Oswald was with the Moretts and tying everything back to the present time, it's also worth discussing Oswald's trip to Mobile, Alabama with them in July of 1963. At that time, Dutch drove Lee, Marina, and other family members to Mobile to visit Dutch and Lillian's son and Oswald's cousin, Jean Moret, who was attending Spring Hill College, a Jesuit school there in Mobile. Lee had been invited to give a talk about life in the Soviet Union to a group of students. While Lee was giving his speech, Marina had to wait outside because women weren't allowed to go inside of the Jesuit House of Studies. A Spring Hill student named Robert Fitzpatrick waited outside of the building with Marina, where he made conversation with her in Russian, a language that he happened to be studying. Fitzpatrick asked Marina if he wrote to her in Russian, would she correct any mistakes that he made, and she said yes. And we know that he did, in fact, send a letter to Marina because it was included as Commission Exhibit 76 in the Warren Report. As far as we know, Marina never responded to the letter. I only bring this up because Robert Fitzpatrick's son, Michael, went on to become the lead singer of Fitz and the Tantrums, a neo-soul band that recently toured with Solving JFK producer Jerry DePizzo's band, OAR, Small World. This episode of Solving JFK is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations. I don't know about you, but when I need to get into that Curtis LeMay, sitting there watching the autopsy vibe, I look for a cigar that I can rely on. And that's why I love Thompson Cigar. They've been around since 1915, so they know a thing or two about cigars. Whether it's a quick five-pack for the weekend or joining one of their value clubs, Thompson makes it easy to save while enjoying top-notch cigars. It's like having your own personal humidor with deals that you can't pass up. Visit www.thompsoncigar.com/JFK or use code JFK at checkout for 20% off of your order of $75 or more. Discover why Thompson has been America's humidor since 1915 and join the thousands of satisfied customers who trust Thompson for quality, value, and exceptional service. From what we just covered, we know that Dutz Moret was associated with Marcello and that Oswald was fairly close with Dutz Moret. So if Marcello wanted to get a message to communicate with Oswald, he could have done it through Moret. But is there any evidence that Oswald ever had any direct contact with Carlos Marcello? While Marcello was incarcerated in the mid-1980s, he said that he had been introduced to Oswald by a man named Ferris, who was Marcello's pilot. Van Lanningham likely meant ferry. He said that the meeting had taken place in Marcello's brother's restaurant and that he met with Oswald several times before he left New Orleans. Joe Hauser was an FBI informant who wore a wire for the feds that captured information leading to Marcello's eventual incarceration. Hauser claimed that Marcello told him that he and some of his men knew Oswald, saying, quote, "I used to know his fucking family. His uncle, he worked for me. That kid worked for me too." Aside from this alleged statement, there's no evidence that Oswald actually worked for Marcello. There's also an allegation from FBI informant Eugene Sumner, who says he was in New Orleans for business in February or March of 1963, and he had dinner at the Town and Country restaurant, which was owned by Marcello and operated by his associate, Joseph Pareto. Sumner told the FBI a few days after JFK was killed that he recalled seeing Oswald eating at the restaurant with a blonde-haired lady. Sumner saw the restaurant owner, who he had been introduced to earlier in the night, quote, join the couple at a table and remove a wad of bills from his pocket, which he passed under the table to the man Sumner identified as Oswald. Before the FBI report on Sumner's statement went public, informant Joe Hauser told the FBI that Marcello mentioned that, quote, the feds came up to the motel asking about Oswald, but my people didn't tell him nothing. Like, we never heard of the guy, you know? So we know that Carlos Marcello was a powerful mob boss in Louisiana and that Texas was part of his territory. But did Marcello have any direct control over Dallas? There were two key Dallas underbosses with whom Marcello spoke regularly on the telephone for many years before and after the JFK assassination. Joe Civello and Joe Campisi. Civello was a narcotics dealer and suspected murderer, and also a legitimate businessman in the liquor business and importation of Italian foods. You may remember from episode 76 that, according to H.L. Hunt's right-hand man, John Currington, Joe Civello met with Hunt at 6 a.m. at the Hunt estate on the morning that Ruby killed Oswald. Civello was a partner in Marcello's racing wire service and leased Marcello's slot machines to bars and nightclubs in Dallas. Civello attended the 1957 Appalachian meeting along with one of Marcello's brothers on Marcello's behalf. File this under the maybe it's nothing, maybe it's a big deal category. Shortly after Civello returned from Appalachian, he was observed having dinner with Dallas Police Sergeant Patrick Dean, who would go on to be in charge of basement security when Jack Ruby killed Oswald. Joe Campisi and his brother Sam owned the Egyptian Lounge restaurant, a notorious mob hangout in Dallas. Civello also frequented the restaurant, according to FBI reports. Campisi had a close relationship with Marcello, as demonstrated by the frequency of phone calls from the Egyptian Lounge to Marcello's businesses in New Orleans. Campisi told HSCA investigators that he used to play golf with Marcello's brothers, and he would send Marcello 260 pounds of Italian sausage every Christmas. As we'll soon see, Joe Civello and Joe Campisi also had a close relationship with Jack Ruby. When Carlos Marcello appeared before the Kefauver Committee in 1951, he refused to answer any questions. Apparently, as a result of that hearing, deportation proceedings began against Marcello in 1953. By 1959, Marcello was still in the United States when he was subpoenaed to testify before the McClellan Committee and the Kennedy brothers, once again invoking the Fifth Amendment for every question. At first, Marcello turned to Santos Traficante to get help from Frank Sinatra to ask the Kennedys to not deport him. But that tactic was unsuccessful. On April 4th, 1961, Marcello went to his regularly scheduled check-in meeting with the INS, where he was arrested and immediately flown to Guatemala because that was the country listed on his false birth certificate. The IRS then filed an $835,000 lien against Marcello and his wife. When Marcello arrived in Guatemala, he was detained for having false documents, and a month later, he was expelled from Guatemala and dropped off late at night at the El Salvador border, according to the HSCA. Marcello later told a prison cellmate that he was taken 20 miles into Honduras and unceremoniously dumped on a jungle hilltop with no signs of civilization in sight. He collapsed multiple times as he trudged through the jungle in his suit, even falling down a hill, which resulted in three broken ribs and cuts from sharp thorns. By late May of 1961, Marcello was somehow able to re-enter the United States. The circumstances of that journey are unclear, but Marcelo would later say that he was flown on a Dominican Air Force jet from Honduras to Miami with the assistance of Senator Russell Long. David Ferry was also involved in Marcelo's return, but he likely flew Marcelo from Florida to New Orleans, not from Honduras to Miami. We know that Ferry was a pilot for Marcelo, and he also worked for G. Ray Gill, one of Marcelo's attorneys. As we discussed in previous episodes, Lee Harvey Oswald was in David Ferry's Civil Air Patrol unit as a teen, and later, in the summer of 1963, Ferry was seen with Oswald by multiple witnesses on multiple occasions. The deportation saga against Marcelo ended when he was acquitted on, of all days, November 22, 1963. Marcelo would later serve a brief stint in prison for assaulting an FBI agent and a longer sentence of 17 years starting in 1982, but Marcelo was able to get out of prison after one of his charges was thrown out on appeal in 1989. During his 6 years of incarceration, Marcelo befriended another older prisoner named Jack Van Lanningham at the Texarkana Federal Correctional Institute. Marcelo struggled with basic reading and would have Van Lanningham read him the newspaper every day. When the prison warden noticed that Van Lanningham was becoming close with Marcelo, he notified the FBI, which led to Agent Thomas Kimmel launching the Camtex operation to see if Marcelo was still running his crime family from prison. Agent Kimmel arranged for Van Lanningham to become Marcelo's cellmate, and audio surveillance was set up in the cell. After Marcelo felt comfortable enough to open up to Van Lanningham, he began sharing incriminating secrets about the JFK assassination, including that he hired two Italians as hitmen who entered the United States through Michigan, just north of Detroit. Marcelo said the two hitmen then went to his Churchill Farm Estates for 10 days before going on to Dallas. Marcelo told Van Lanningham, quote, "Yeah, I had the son of a bitch killed. I'm glad I did. I'm sorry I couldn't have done it myself." While the Camtex audio recordings remain classified, Van Lanningham did pass a polygraph about his claims. Obviously, in the interest of transparency, these audio recordings must be released immediately and in full. In episode 68, we talked about FBI informant Eugene De La Parra overhearing three men in a Marcelo restaurant discussing the president's murder in March of 1963. De La Parra said that one of them, who he believed to be David Ferry, said, quote, "There's a price on the president's head and somebody will get Kennedy when he comes down south." There was also another alleged confession by Marcelo, this one to Ed Becker. Becker claimed that he met Marcelo in September of 1962 at his Churchill Farms estate. When the topic turned to Bobby Kennedy, Marcelo said in Italian, quote, "Take the stone out of my shoe. Don't worry about that little Bobby son of a bitch. He's going to be taken care of." Becker said that Marcelo then referred to President Kennedy as being a dog and the Attorney General as being the dog's tail and said, quote,
"The dog will keep biting you if you cut off his tail, but if the dog's head were cut off, the dog would die."
The credibility of Ed Becker is a mixed bag. Mob-connected attorney Sidney Korshak called Becker a, quote, "no good shakedown artist." But then again, what else would a mob attorney call someone who's turning state's evidence on his client? Conversely, the New York Times called Becker, quote, "the most significant link in the relationship between the crime syndicate, politics, labor, and management." A former FBI agent and chief investigator for Los Angeles said that Becker worked for him and was, quote, "one of the most knowledgeable detail men in the private investigator business." FBI files confirm that Becker was in Louisiana in September of 1962 when he said the meeting took place. Further, Becker did know Marcello through his nephew, Carl Rapolo. According to mob lawyer Frank Regano, when Santos Traficante was seriously ill in 1987, he implied that Marcello was the ultimate decider behind the assassination, saying, quote, "I think Carlos fucked up getting rid of Giovanni. Maybe it should have been Bobby." Next time on Solving JFK, we revisit the life, times, and relationships of Jack Ruby. Did Ruby really have mafia ties? And is that the reason why he killed Lee Harvey Oswald? If you heard anything that you believe is out of context, or if you have additional information to offer, you can let us know at solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide citations to the record for any fact that you're relying on. For transcripts, sources, and official podcast merchandise, visit SolvingJFKPodcast.com. Thanks for listening. Visit SolvingJFKPodcast.com for more information.